So tell me about Clarion.
Clarion. So, well, I mean, there's not a whole lot to say except that.
Because it was Clarion on the brink and you guys brought it back.
Well, sure, yeah. There's a nonprofit now. So Clarion's the oldest science fiction writer's workshop in the world. It was founded by Damon Knight and Kate Wilhelm a little over 30 years ago, 35 years ago now. So my year in 1992 was the year 25, so do the math, 37 years or something. Clarion was founded some 37 years ago, and it's a writer's workshop that has graduated some of the greats of our field, Bruce Sterling and Nalo Hopkinson, Kathy Koja, and Octavia Butler, Lucia Shepard, and Dan Simmons, and myself. You know, counting myself in that company is the height of ego, but, you know, lots of writers enjoy. Well, if you're listening to this podcast, it might be because you like my books, too, so knowing that would be. But you know, certainly a lot of my literary heroes came out of that workshop. And it's a six-week writer's workshop that requires you to kind of really stop your life in its tracks and take off more time off work than most people can get. A lot of people end up quitting their jobs to do it.
So I'm thinking of applying. How many people apply? How many people get in?
I don't know. I wasn't involved in admissions, but okay. I know last year that we were short of what are the applications we would have wanted, because it's a kind of expensive thing to do. And again, I don't know the number for next year. You can find it on the website. But the problem with it has been not that there was a lack of demand for the workshop. The problem with it has been that the Michigan state educational system has been gutted. And and when you're thinking about whether you're going to have the funding to teach freshman English next year, deciding whether or not you're going to continue funding this legendary, amazing writer's workshop is it's actually kind of a no-brainer, right? You know, it's like, and when you're cut to the bone by an administration that has had, you know, its federal transfer funding cut way back and has had its ability to raise money in the state cut way back by the, you know, breaking the backs of the unions and the elimination of the auto industry and all the rest of it, it becomes really, really hard, right? So when it became clear that Michigan State wasn't going to have the long-term wherewithal to run the writer's workshop, a group of friends of the workshop, led by Kate Wilhelm, one of the founders of the workshop, formed a 501c3 to create a charitable organization that would oversee it. And so we're trying to figure out kind of what its long-term home is. I can't really comment on negotiations with MSU, but they're underway. Figuring out whether MSU is the right place for it to go long term, or whether some other place might be the right place for it to go, and what its long term future is. And we're working with friends of Clarion, graduates of Clarion, you know, former faculty of Clarion.
It's cool. It's like a university. It gets its alums to
open up
their wallets.
Exactly. You know? It's doing exactly what any other university program would do. Clarion West, which is not formally affiliated, although it's wildly cross-pollinated. All those people are friends of Clarion East and vice versa. There is the smallest amount of rivalry among the students. I mean, and completely friendly, more in the line of good-natured ribbing than anything else. And I think it was either my Clarion or the Clarion afterwards. The joke was we were Clarion Classic and they were the new Clarion, and we sent a case of Coke Classic to Clarion West. But it's on that level. It's not like, you know, it's not like, oh, you bastards, you know, you went to the
two-pack versus dirty bastard or whatever.
Or even MSU versus state, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not Ann Arbor versus East Lansing, right? I mean, it is the friendliest of rivalries. But the Clarion West people are genius for recruiting armies of volunteers who really make that workshop happen.
Yep.
Right? They're really, really, really good at this. And there's a Clarion South program now in Australia that's done some good work, and there's some rumbles about a Clarion North in Toronto that's done some good work, you know. And so, you know, Clarion East is just sort of is moving into that next step. And it's great. I mean, it's an honor to work with the board. The board includes people from, you know, Karen Joy Fowler to Kim Stanley Robinson. It's an amazing collection of people who are committed to this and who are real leading lights of the field, and so that's really pleasant to be involved with. Walter John Williams is on the board, and so on. I'm honored to be in their company. And my small contribution has been to recruit a volunteer, a guy named Brad Kahn, who was my business partner in a software company that I founded and that we subsequently sold, called Ovencola. Brad is a lifelong advertising executive. He was a P&G, Procter & Gamble exec. He ran all their attack brands in Canada, then was a senior vice president at Gray, you know, multi-billion-dollar international ad agency, and he's now at a marketing and technology company called Points. He's their chief marketing officer, and And grad did a little bit of pro bono work for us and developed a small campaign, very modest, just some banners as you've seen, and a landing page telling articulating the benefits of the workshop. And it's been great. We've been attracting lots of interest. Lots of friends of the workshop have donated us some space on their webpage to host that material, to host a little banner, and have sometimes even written a little testimonial about what Clarion means to them. And it's attracted a larger pool of applicants and really raised the profile of the workshop and helped to sustain it. So that's great.
Yeah. I never really even heard of it or paid much attention to it until I got in trouble. And then I started seeing when you guys started, you know, having it and everything, you know.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's in some ways an unfortunately well-kept secret in the field, you know. And I think everyone who's involved with Clarion, has ever been involved with Clarion, will tell you that there are great, you can be a great writer without going to Clarion. And there are writers for whom Clarion won't give them any benefit. And that one of the things that Clarion does for a lot of writers who attend it is shows them that they don't really want to be a writer.
Right.
So, I mean, all of those are, like, those are useful services, I think, to provide to the field, and they're all true. But there are a lot of people, myself included, for whom Clarion was a watershed, right? Clarion was the thing that took us from being almost there to there. And we might have made it on our own, but Clarion sure helped. Jeff Vandermeer was one of my classmates and so on, you know?
Yeah. Well, nifty. I don't want to eat up all of your time.
Yeah, I got to kind of go and prep another interview in an hour, so yeah, I got to go to my room and get sorted out and check out, too.
So I'm going to give you one thing. You won't take a book, I understand. I don't want a throwing fight, but I'm going to give you a card.
Oh, good. Okay. And I'll give you some of mine.
And this will be an incentive to maybe give me a shout-out on one of your well-read things. Because, you know, Harold...
Sure.
You read Harold stuff, don't you? Harold Feld?
Yeah, sure, sometimes, yeah. Well, you know what? Come up with a news hook about something and send it to me, and I'll...
Can I show you one thing?
Sure, yeah, of course.
So, and you can...
I just need one.
All right, there's the flip side. It's got my two books.
Oh, it's a beautiful card.
And I believe, Gary did them for me.
Nice.
Gary did the covers of my... That card. I did that sucky cover. He did
the
nice
like
one.
That very much.
Yeah. But, so my new book... That,
can I see this?
Oh, sure.
That's a nice device.
Yeah. No DRM.
Of course. Good.
Plays OGG.
And what kind of? That's USB.
Yeah.
And does it take removable media, or does it just have some onboard?
It has a hard disk. You know? It's a 30 gig.
30 gig. Beautiful.
Yeah.
What a nice little device.
Yeah. And it did video before the video iPod came out.
Oh,
and,
cool.
I've written a novel. I'm writing a little novella. It's set in a 1984. That's half Orwell's 1984 and half Reagan's 1984.
I love 1984.
And so these are some of the nifty. So this is I made this place up. This is run by the Ministry of Love Changes, where old thing becomes new thing. You know.
Nice.
When I get this ready, if you could give this a shout-out. I'm going to put this all online. This is all...
It's cool. Are you going to do, a little podcast of the story?
Yeah, I am. It's not all written yet, but I've got a few more illustrations coming. It's about reanimation of frozen heads is the basic story.
That's beautiful, Ellis. Who's doing the Ellis?
A guy named Matt Hemming goes by Cheeseburger Brown on Corrosion and a bunch of other sites like that. So anyway, if I send you a link to this, will you give me a shout out?
Yeah, of course. It's beautiful.
Yeah, isn't this cool?
My agent, I got a little film option feeler on a story that I'd podcast, and came through my agent, and my agent hadn't read the story, and so the story had originally been printed, right?
Yep.
And it was podcast, and he said, "Oh well, you know, I've got this long commute. Why don't I listen to the podcast instead of reading the story? I've never tried a podcast before."
Right.
So he tried listening to the podcast. And he was kind of transfixed. He was like, there is a huge pool of people who control licensing for, who control licensing decision making for films,
right.
Who don't have any time to read paper, but who for whom a long commute in a car figures heavily into their daily round. This is a great way for a book agent to pitch a film agent or for a producer on works that they should take under consideration. You know, hire an actor to bang off, ten short stories in an afternoon. The cost is pretty small, and then just produce some podcasts.
Funny you should mention that. I'm also working on a film TV script with a guy who's an actor, working Hollywood actor. So I should get him. Hey, buddy, read this for me.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like it's a thing that it's ecologically suited to fitting into the life of yeah. someone who's got a very busy office bound round,
right.
but who you know, if you try to squeeze something into the life of someone whose every moment is spoken for when they're at their desk, and it's something that they have to be at their desk to do.
Right.
It's going to fall to the bottom of the pile. Whereas if you take a part of their life where it's not productive hours and where it's actually sort of frustrating, counterproductive hours, and give them something productive to do in it.
Right.
Maybe they'll do it. You know.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I've just been too lazy to do the podcast. I'm too lazy to do anything, as Gary will tell you. I write about technology for a living. That's what I've done for the last 25 years.
Right.
But I don't use it very well. I'm really stupid. I couldn't even figure out what my own cell phone number was.
Yeah, I
you
saw
know?
That.
And I'm just, and that's fine. I mean, I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I lived in a mud hut for 3 years.
Where'd you go?
In Senegal, in West Africa.
Nice.
And so, and I grew up on a farm, and I'm very much a conflicted low-tech, high-tech guy. And my, you know, it's funny, because when I started Wet Machine, I said, I want to be the anti-boing boing. Because boing boing, it's great and it's interesting, but it's all about the wonders of technology and the great marvels. And I'm a techno paranoid, and I want to have a Terminator 2, Fear the Future website with everything bad that
hey,
this
do you
new
know,
globalized.
Do you know John Hughes, the citizen cyborg guy?
No.
So he talks about, like, from in a biotech perspective, he talks about bioconservatives,
right.
who are people who really their whole the master narrative of biotech for them is a disaster narrative, right?
Right.
And so he talks a lot about bioconservatism as,
right.
As kind of the antithesis of you know sort of transhumanism.
Right.
And I think it's a
but this book
a good
here
access.
Is a lampoon of transhumanism.
Right.
Yeah.
It's easy
yeah.
to make fun of.
Yeah.
Now I'd recommend Citizen Cyborg to you highly.
Okay.
Because one of the things that he does is articulate a kind of liberal democratic humanist response to bioconservatism. Because one of the things about bioconservatism is the idea that it will increase the gap between the haves and have-nots. You know that you know if you can eliminate cancer in your germline by spending $500,000 on genetic therapy for your you know your IVR program. Then rich people become superhuman,
right?
Right. Rich people get an advantage that poor
right.
people you know can't avail themselves of.
Right.
But he says you know that's true of things like casts. If you break a bone, right? If you can afford to go to the hospital and get
right.
your bone fixed, then you have this giant advantage over people who can't, right?
Right.
Well, the liberal democratic response to that has always been universal health care.
Right,
right, not banning castes, and
right.
so he comes up with this idea that's basically universal transhumanism, right? Universal liberal democratic transhumanist access to technology,
right.
And, which is an amazing theme in Citizen Cyborg. I don't know that I'm totally sold on it, but I
right.
do think it's a fascinating thing. And Hughes himself is bright as hell.
Yeah, no,
and,
I don't doubt it. And I when I say I'm a techno-paranoid, you know, retrograde bioconservative, obviously it's a lot of bullshit to that too, because it's what I do for a living, right?
Right, right.
You know, so, however, I am conservative in a lot of philosophically, a foot dragger. It's not that I want to I'm not a fundamentalist. I want to, you know, limit what you can do with your body, for
right,
example,
right.
right? I don't want to make laws that say we can't do this or that.
Right.
There's few, but you know, there's this problem of hysteresis. There is, I wrote an article for Salon about the Human Genome Project and the implications for a backlash against people who have disabilities,
right.
which are real, and it's really happening. This is not theoretical, especially special education. And, you know, like, you know, if you have a kid today who's born with a genetic defect that you knew about when you were pregnant, there's all kinds of people who say, well, what the right did you have that kid, right? And
yeah,
now come,
sure.
And now come to us. Asking
well,
us to subsidize
and writ large, you know,
yeah.
cochlear implants, right? If
right.
you refuse to implant your child at an age where they can become
a hearing person,
and insist that they become a deaf person first,
right?
You know,
yes.
I just finished reading Rebuilt, the Charest book,
uh-huh.
the guy who the computer scientist who was could hear partially through his life, and then became profoundly and totally deaf, and had a cochlear implant, and spent a lot of time. Hacking the firmware with the computer scientists who developed it at the company until he could hear Bolero.
Uh-huh.
Because he did Bolero was his favorite composition, and the way that the firmware...
I think
worked,
I'd have an operation so I could never hear Bolero. But anyway...
Well, it was throwing away parts of the acoustic information
right.
that it considered superfluous to understanding speech, but were essential to understanding
Bolero. Right, right.
You know, and so
it's called Rebuilt.
It's called Rebuilt by Charost, Chorost, He also had a great article about Bolero in Wired magazine.
Okay. There should be three.
Yeah. Well, I'm very conflicted about a lot of this stuff, you know. I don't think, for example, I don't think all anti-abortion arguments are stupid, you know. Although I'm not, you know, I'm a pro-choice person myself, but I don't think that all the moral arguments are, you know, ipso facto stupid. I think most of them are, but you know, so there are plausible arguments about trying to understand what it is to be a human and you know, and not doing violence to things that are human. I think that's a reasonable, you know.
I guess right? So. I mean, we could, if we're going to start talking about abortion, we're not going to finish in anything like a reasonable amount of time. So.
Well, no, we probably agree with each other, so we could, you know.
Right.
Well, we agree close enough.
I mean, I grew up very active in the pro-choice movement. I was a bump in my mother's belly when I went to my first pro-choice marches. And in Canada, it was legalized through a guerrilla doctor who openly operated abortion clinics and went to jail repeatedly for it. The first photo of me ever in the newspaper is this guy holding me up in the air at the age of 4 at a fundraiser to bail him out of his latest legal trouble, a guy named Dr. Henry Morgenthaler.
Uh-huh.
So, and I used to do clinic defense, and you know, they blew up his clinics and stuff.
Wow.
Morgenthaler's amazing, he's an Auschwitz survivor. And when he got an injunction against Campaign Life, who were blockading his clinics, and when they put him on the stand, their lawyer said, Dr. Morgenthaler, you're an Auschwitz survivor. And he said, yes. And they said, you know, can you show the court? And he rolled up his sleeve and showed them the number. And he said, what's the ratio of Jewish to Gentile babies you murder in your mortuary?
Yeah.
And he said, say what now? And he said, well, are you seeking revenge on the Christian world for what they did to you and your people in Auschwitz? And like the judge basically threw them out, right? I mean, this was an astonishing low for them to have sunk to. I mean, real bottom scraping, right? But I mean,
and also claiming Nazis were Christian is kind of
Yeah, I think Hitler had a whole Odin thing going on.
Right.
That's why Norway was so symbolically important to him, but. Anyway, I should probably get a move on.
Yeah.
Send me an email about this when it's done. One UI suggestion is I hate things where it's like to see this picture, click here, and then it pops up a new window.
This is not public. This is just me and the artist.
Because for me it's like I know how to make something show up in a new tab. I hold down the command button before I click it.
Yeah.
But if it opens in a new window, I can't make it open in a new tab. Whereas if it opens in a new tab, I can choose whether or not I want a new tab or not.
Right. So this is just. There's now three people in the world under that.
Okay,
right?
Cool.
This is just me and the artist communicating.
Cool. Well, I think it's lovely, and his work looks great. There's a guy named Damien something who did a bunch of fan illos for Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town.
Yeah.
And his style really reminds me of it. He's a great illustrator.
Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, guys.
Well, thank you very much
for
the time.
Sorry we couldn't find more time.
Thank you.
I'm teaching Viable Paradise in October, so if you're Martha's Vineyard, maybe we can see you.
Oh, absolutely.